Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Thanks so much for joining me again this week. As you know, we talk all things law enforcement here on Blue Lives Radio. We have very interesting guests, and you always get my view from the blue. So, before we get into that, I want you to make sure that you check me out on Facebook. Go to Randy Sutton Public Figure and just like that little button right there, and you can see everything that I post and that I write. Got some major stuff coming up, and I want you to be aware of it. I'm going to tell you on the air here. And the other thing that I would like to mention is that if you have a topic that you would like me to discuss, things that you want me to bring up, or even a guest that you think would be interesting, contact me, and I'll see what I can do to put it on the air. So let's take a walk into the briefing room, where I'm going to give you my view from the blue.
The Briefing Room. Headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
It isn't the first time that I've talked about this guy. He is the sheriff of Multnomah County, Oregon, near Portland. I've talked about him before when he pulled some other bonehead stuff, but he's really outdone himself. You know, it seems like I'm always talking about people from Northwest or California when it comes down to just ridiculous actions that they do. So, it's the sheriff of Multnomah County, and his name is Reese, by the way. Sheriff Reese, Mike Reese. He got elected by the snowflake community of, you know, the Portland area, and has been really pushing a liberal agenda onto his law enforcement officers. A couple months ago, you'll remember that some of his deputies, in a break room only used by deputies in the county courthouse, had posted a thin blue line flag. The thin blue line flag is a flag that symbolizes the fallen police officers of this nation. It looks like an American flag, except it's got a blue stripe on it. And it symbolizes something very, very important to the American law enforcement officer. And that is the sacrifice that all law enforcement officers make when they give their lives in the line of duty. What could possibly be objectionable to that? Well, Sheriff Reese, in his wisdom, ordered that this flag be removed because some people found it objectionable. Well, first of all, Sheriff, you should have had the guts to say, if you find it objectionable, cram it. But you didn't. And instead, you ordered the flag to be removed. The local Fraternal Order of Police was incensed, and they issued a press release about it. And this spineless sheriff made some ridiculous kind of excuses that you know, here's the real reason. He's looking for votes. And these are voters that are anti-law enforcement. So he didn't care about what his cops felt, what the deputies felt. He didn't care about doing what was right. He pandered to votes. So I wrote about that, and we had a very lively discussion about it. By the way, I also reached out to him and offered him the opportunity to come onto the show and explain himself. He refused to call me back. I know that's not a surprise to anyone. Well, he's back in the news. He's back in the news again. And this time, he's playing with people's lives for political purposes. The headline of this news story: deputies investigated by their agency for cooperating with ICE agents. Mm-hmm. So, we all know that there are individuals with exceedingly liberal agendas. We know that. We get it. They consider themselves to be sanctuary cities or communities or states or whatever. The only thing that ICE is asking is that they be notified when they have a detainer on someone. And for those of you that don't know what a detainer is, it's a legal process by which one agency can ask another agency to hold on to someone once they are about to be released in order to pick them up and transport them to their own facility. It's a 48-hour hold, so to speak. It's been done all over the country for ever since God made little peach pits. They're detainers. It's normal in the course of business. Well, since all of this hyper liberalism involving undocumented aliens, this issue is going on steroids. So the mainstream media and politicians are making it sound like the police are acting as immigration agents, and they're not. I totally agree that police should not be immigration agents. That's not their job. There is a separation there. ICE does what ICE does. Their mission is to enforce immigration laws. Okay? That's their job. But there is federal law here. Federal law trumps, if you'll pardon the expression, state and local laws. And when there is a lawful detainer, it doesn't become an option here. This isn't some to, I want to use this law but not use that law. This doesn't give discretion, but somehow you get politicians like this Sheriff Reese, who has decided not only not to honor what he is required to honor by way of these detainers, he's decided that he's going to wage a campaign of intimidation by investigating his own department members for complying with the law. I want you to think about this for a minute. Think what a chilling effect this must have on law enforcement in Multnomah County. Let me say this. From my literally hundreds of contacts with law enforcement officers per week, I get a very consistent issue that presents itself in majority of the communications, and that is that street level officers and working cops are more afraid of their own administrations than they are of the bad guys. This is a really bad situation. There's always been something of a disconnect there, but we're seeing it on levels that I've never seen before. Now, here we have a sheriff who's an elected official. He doesn't have the pressure from the city councils like police chiefs do, who can literally fire you at a whim. He's an elected official. The only thing that could get him out of office is to be voted out or a recall. Well, that's not very likely to happen, that is, as far as a recall goes. But he doesn't have to answer to anyone except the voters. So what is he doing? He is pandering to the voters. Now, I want to take this even a little step further with you. I want to tell you about corruption. I lecture all over the country. I present to police agencies all over the country on a topic called Policing with Honor. And during this, it's an ethics-related presentation. It's a seminar. And when I consider one of the most important aspects of law enforcement, I consider police ethics to be at the very top of the list. Comes right under survival, as far as I'm concerned. So I talk about this in a very specific way. And I've been doing this for years. So I'm very, very familiar with law enforcement corruption issues, with some of the scandals that have rocked police agencies all over this country. So I understand what corruption is. It's defined as the misuse of public power for private benefit. When you think about that, misuse of public power for private benefit, you know, when you're thinking normal police corruption, you're thinking things like, the Serpico incident where Frank Serpico, uncovered just widespread financial corruption within the New York City Police Department years ago. When you think of corruption, it's taking money for not doing your job. It's for trading sex for not doing your job. It's for giving favors out. That's the traditional kind of thinking when it comes down to police corruption. But there's something else at play, and it's called administrative corruption. Now, this is a topic that, police administrators hate when I bring up sheriffs and chiefs and high-level administrators, because they don't like to recognize that this exists. Administrative corruption is the misuse of administrative power for private benefit. That can be simply not liking somebody that works for you and using the power that you have administratively to destroy their careers or to make their lives miserable. But it also is what I'm thinking about this Sheriff Reese pandering for votes by misusing his administrative power by investigating his own officers and ordering them not to follow the law. And his private benefit? Votes. His private benefit is votes. This is administrative corruption at its very finest. Something needs to be done. The only investigation that should be taking place here is the Department of Justice needs to be investigating Sheriff Reese. That's the real investigation that should be taking place, instead of Sheriff Reese investigating his own people for simply following the law. Once again, I have reached out to Sheriff Reese to offer him the opportunity to come on to this show and explain himself. I wouldn't be counting your or holding your breath for that, because I don't think I'm going to be given a response. But if he does, I guarantee you that I will bring him to you. Now I want to talk about just the opposite kind of sheriff. A sheriff who is down in Wicomico County, which is a county in Maryland. And this is a totally different kind of law enforcement leader. And this is the kind of leader that I like. He's got the guts to stand up for himself, and he's not afraid to say what he thinks. Sheriff Mike Lewis of the Wicomico County, Maryland Sheriff's Department. Now, what did he do? He exercised his First Amendment rights. And you guessed it. Social media, the bane of law enforcement in many places in the United States. So Sheriff Lewis went onto his own personal Facebook page, and he wanted to talk about his thoughts of those who are kneeling, those football players who are kneeling at the national anthem during these games. You all know how I feel about it, and you probably share my thoughts on that. But Sheriff Lewis decided to say something. And in a post, he refers to the Ravens football team game protesters as, let me quote, "poor, self-proclaimed, underprivileged, fist-wielding black power advocates, activists who do nothing but decry the hardworking men and women of American law enforcement," unquote. Well, you would think that Sheriff Lewis had done something, had raped a baby on Town Square or something for the outcry that the media and social activists have taken upon. They're calling for his ouster. They want him charged. I mean, it is absolute madness. And this is because he had the nerve to actually say something that he believed on his own personal Facebook page. Not his department Facebook page, his personal Facebook page. When did law enforcement officers give up their First Amendment rights? How did that happen in the land of the free? Because law enforcement officers, unfortunately, over the last few years, have fallen prey to political correctness in ways that is absolutely astounding. And this is one of them. Now, I got to tell you this. When I read this news report, I had to post about it. So I put it on my Facebook posted this incident, where I supported the sheriff for what his decisions were and the fact that he has a right to say whatever the hell he wants to say. And I got unbelievable responses. And one of the responses was from a police officer who had attended one of the sheriff's classes. Well, now, I want to say that virtually every single response that I got was positive for the sheriff, every single one. But this one hit home because this guy talked about 14 or 15 years ago, he attended a class being given by the sheriff, who apparently lectures on subjects around the country. And he had to pay for the class out of his own pocket because his department didn't have the budget. Many cops do that because they want to better themselves. So this officer had to brown bag and make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches because he couldn't afford to go out and get lunch like everybody else did. Well, apparently, the sheriff saw this and saw that this man had financial issues because he was bringing his own lunch. Well, what did he do? He paid for this police officer's lunch every single day of this seminar. He didn't have to do that. He did it because this shows a man's character. A man's character who truly cares about the people that not only does he serve, but those in law enforcement. So I reached out to this sheriff, just like I did to Sheriff Reese. But you know what? This sheriff actually called me back. Yep, Sheriff Reese and I had a conversation. And he's going to be on this show either next week or the week after. And he and I had a fantastic conversation. This is the kind of sheriff that I would work for any day. So I can't wait for him to give you his views on one of the shows in the near future. But it shows you the difference in leadership. And that, my friends, is this week's View from the Blue. I want to take a minute and tell you about an incredible security company. Now, I've dealt with a lot of security folks, and some have been less than professional. This company is amazing, JSD Protective Services. Now, they're all over the country, and they do amazing stuff. They're armed security. They do courier work. They do private investigations. They do it all, and they do it well. And the reason that they do it so well is because of their training. They put their folks through some amazing training that's very comparable to law enforcement training. So JSD Protective Services, they're all over the United States, and you can find them at jsdprotectiveservices.com. That's jsdprotectiveservices.com. For all your security needs, they are the best. Give them a call. Or actually, hit them up on their website, jsdprotectiveservices.com. Before we take a walk into the interview room, one thing I wanted to let you know is that I recently had the honor of being a keynote speaker down in Texas. And I got to tell you that one of the things that I really enjoy is getting to meet personally with the people that listen to this radio program. So if you would like to talk to me about addressing your group, whether it is a law enforcement or a civic group or even a volunteer group, let me know. Contact me at randysutton@americaoutloud.com. Thanks. Now let's take a walk into the interview room.
Let the silent voices be heard. It's the rallying call that started it all. AmericaOutloud.com. For a wide spectrum of programming from world and political news, societal and cultural stories, law enforcement, our military heroes, and much more. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health. Sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa. award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
Hello and welcome to the Interview Room at Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I'm your host, Randy Sutton, and I have a very fascinating guest today. An individual who has found his way home after battling the demons of post-traumatic stress disorder. He's a 12-year veteran police officer, forced to leave the job because of the effects of PTSD, but he has a fascinating story. There is a way back. Troy Foster, thank you so much for being on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Randy, and thank you for being a voice for law enforcement itself.
I appreciate that. You know, Troy, you contacted me. It was in reference to a Facebook post that I put up concerning the way people have been treated by their departments after being injured, either physically or psychologically. And I found your story fascinating, and I wanted to invite you onto the show to share it because many people, once they feel the effects of post-traumatic stress, they fall deeply into an abyss, and your story is amazing. Now, you were a 12-year sheriff's deputy with the Pratt County Sheriff's Office in Kansas, right?
Yes, Pratt County is where the last agency I worked for, where my career ended.
And how many deputies are on that sheriff's department?
Pratt County has just under 15 deputies, and that would include jail staff and, you know, detectives and all of that.
So it's a small agency, and the reason that I find that that's important, and I want to, you know, share this with my audience, is it doesn't matter the size of your agency. Law enforcement officers all face the same dangers. They see the same things, whether you are in the largest city in the country or the smallest agency in the country. And that's really important that people understand that. So, you know, let's talk about your career. You came on as a sheriff's deputy, and did you enjoy the job?
You know, I loved the job, Randy. And like most officers, I got into it because I had a heart for helping people and, you know, just making a difference in my community. So it was my passion, and I put my heart and soul into my work.
And you were a well-recognized deputy. I mean, you did a lot of different things during your career.
Yeah, I became very successful at drug interdiction, and I was one of the well-known interdiction officers in the state of Kansas. And so I was very fortunate in my career, got to see a lot of drugs, a lot of vehicles, a lot of cash that came with, you know, drug proceeds, and I got to put a lot of criminals in jail.
And you were well recognized by your sheriff and within the professional community.
Yes, sir. And I was also known through the state with my interdiction abilities and the amounts of drugs that I had seized. So I was pretty fortunate.
And what else did you do in your career? I mean, did you do any special units?
I was a canine officer for about 3 years in the heart of my interdiction. And then I was also a team leader on our tactical team the last 2 years of my law enforcement career.
So you were a stud cop, man. You were out there doing the job. You were on the tactical team. You had a lot of training, a lot of experience. What happened that led you down that path?
Well, I was just like a lot of guys, you know. I put my heart and soul into the job, and it really became my identity. And I love my work. But, you know, as time goes by and officers start seeing different things in their career, you know, some guys handle that differently. Some can stuff it. Some are able to talk about it. But I started dealing with severe depression about the last 3 years of my career. And I knew I was in some trouble because I started feeling suicidal pretty regularly. But I can't tell you that there was one certain thing that sparked the depression, but I know a couple of suicides that I worked triggered it a little bit, and it just seemed to really go downhill fast. And so I was battling that.
There are some people that get affected by post-traumatic stress from singular events, but the cumulative events of being a cop, I think, plays a bigger role in the post-traumatic stress world, if you will.
Yes, sir. I would agree with you there, Randy. And you know, looking back, I can name many things that affected my mental health in the post-traumatic stress, and it just all seemed to just pile on.
Well, let's talk about a few of those. What were those very significant events that you think triggered the post-traumatic stress?
Well, I know a suicide of someone that I knew affected me very dearly. And, you know, I didn't know him well, but I can still play that scene in my head and having to carry his wife out of the house as she saw him hanging.
Was he a cop?
No, he wasn't. No, he was just a citizen, as someone I knew that lived in the community that I worked. But that was very hard on me. And, you know, I think probably what affected me as a part of that is I was starting to feel suicidal at that time. So when I saw those suicides, it very well was very heavy on my conscience, because I felt alone. I didn't know who I could talk to, or I didn't feel like I could reach out to anybody, especially being an officer on the road. I mean, that was my whole life, and I was in fear if anybody found out that I would lose my career. And, you know, if I lost my career, then I felt like I didn't really have anything to live for.
I think you just said one of the most critical aspects: feeling alone and not feeling like you could talk to someone. Did your department, was it like a supportive department, or did you think that if you went up and talked to your sheriff, because you had a relationship with your sheriff, right?
I did. My sheriff was like a father figure to me. And so, you know, I wanted to do a good job for him, and I wanted to be a good deputy. And so I was scared to tell him, and I didn't want to be taken off the road. And, you know, I just didn't want him to feel let down, like I had done something wrong or couldn't do my job any longer. But I was just in fear. I was really scared of him to feel shameful of me for the way I felt.
That must have been a pretty alone feeling.
Yeah, there were some really dark days. I mean, you know, if I was going to be honest and, you know, share that, there were many days I sat in a patrol car and almost took my own life. I was just so alone, and I felt so much shame and guilt that I didn't think anybody would understand. And so it was a very lonely time in my life, very, you know, dark, and that God got me through it. Thank the Lord.
Well, let's go back to those days for a moment. You didn't wake up one day feeling depression. I mean, these things they happen over time. When did you start realizing that you've got issues?
Well, as I said, about 3 years outside of when my career was about over, I started feeling depression. So what I did is, I was married at the time and I was having marital issues. And so I started seeing I went to a doctor and started talking to somebody. And I think a lot of times what happens is, doctors, they push medications on people and they want them to feel better. But I started taking some different medications at the recommendation of a psychiatrist. And I truly believe that those medications enhanced my feelings of suicide and made me feel a lot worse than I was feeling at the time. But I, because of their recommendations, I kept taking those medications thinking that the problem was me.
Right.
And that my PTSD was getting worse. And so I really believed that I needed those medications to survive. And but as I was taking those, I just felt, worse and worse. And I became suicidal every day. I mean, I can remember waking up, putting the uniform on, wondering if that was the day I was going to end my life.
What kind of medications were they putting you on?
Well, just your standard antidepressants. I remember, if I was going to name a few of them, Paxil and Remeron, and they had me on a concoction of different mixes, but every time I would mention, that I was still feeling the same, they would want to try this or try something different. And I just never could feel like I was gaining control of my depression or PTSD.
Did they ever diagnose you with PTSD? I mean, did you ever have a psychologist or psychiatrist say, here's what the problem is, you've got post-traumatic stress and we've got to treat it with something other than drugs?
Well, not at the time, and that's a good question. At the time, no. When I started taking all those medications, no one recognized that as the situation going on. But how it all came to pass is in my last year of law enforcement, one of my coworkers that I knew, he was a state trooper, he pulled over into a parking lot and shot himself. And, seeing the scene of that and those images, I could never get out of my head. And that really threw me into a deeper depression and PTSD, because after he did that, it made me think, wow, that's going to be me at any time. And that really scared me, because I had a wife and a young daughter, and I didn't want to leave them, and I didn't want to leave my family, but I just didn't have any hope. And then about six months later, one of my best friends, he was my best friend not only on duty but off duty. We did a lot of stuff together. And we were dispatched to his home one morning to a year-and-a-half-old child not breathing. And I recognized the address. And, when it's a child, just everybody goes. It's children hit home for officers. Most officers have children. And I responded to the scene with EMS, and my friend's year-and-a-half-old son was laying on the floor blue. And so EMS started CPR. I helped him grab needed equipment and was handing him equipment as they were doing CPR. And then they took his son to the hospital. And those memories, Randy, are memories I'll never forget. It was just like, it was like a Hollywood movie at the hospital. Those emergency doors were swinging open, and I could see the doctors and nurses frantically trying to save his life. And after about 40 minutes, the doctor came out, and obviously he had a sad look on his face, and he kneeled down and grabbed my friend and his wife's hand, and you know, he said, I'm just really sorry he didn't make it. And that incident there really threw me over the edge.
I can imagine. Because
I had a 6 week old daughter at the time, and my sheriff ended up giving me a couple days off, paid days off, because he knew I wasn't doing good. And I think then that they should have recognized something was really wrong, but, you know, maybe they looked at the situation as just what it was, as, you know, an officer lost his kid, and I was friends with him, and I was just grieving.
Did you notice anything when you started really feeling the effects and you were taking the medication, it wasn't helping? Did you see that your performance on the job was changing?
It did. I started not wanting to really go out and work as hard because I wanted to isolate myself from the others. You know, in law enforcement, we've got to be around other brothers and sisters that are out working. And there came a time I just tried to stay out in the county and not be around my coworkers as much, because I was really depressed, and I just didn't want them asking a lot of questions, because I was in fear if I revealed what was going on in my life, my career was gone.
What I'm really curious is, do you think that change in your performance was or should have been noticed by your sergeant or by your, you know, somebody in the organization? Did they notice that things had changed?
You know, they did notice, Randy. I remember, you know, my spouse at the time telling me that, you know, some of my coworkers had mentioned to her that I just didn't seem like I was the same person, that I was more withdrawn and more irritable, and I seemed kind of on the edge and more moody and not as able to communicate with them like I had been.
And you know, I think this is a really critical thing for my listeners to know and to understand, that when we see these changes in our coworkers, or you know, if there's people that we supervise, these are warning signs. And you know, when we owe it to each other, you know, we're great at putting ourselves and backing each other up when there's physical danger, but it has to go beyond that. We have to care about each other enough to step in and say, you know, what's going on? You know, perhaps if somebody had come up to you and said, look, you know, what's going on with you? Is there a way that I can help? Maybe you would have been touched enough to get some assistance.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of dangers with that also, Randy, is, you know, a lot of times other officers don't know what to say, so they don't say anything at all. And that's really, you could be saving somebody's life by just reaching out and being a friend and have an open dialogue and conversation about what's going on in somebody's life.
Exactly. So, I mean, what was it that caused your career to end?
Well, not long after my friend's son died, I had another friend of mine. He was shot and killed on a domestic call. And he worked for another agency in the state of Kansas. It wasn't my agency. But after all that happened, it just had all built up. And I came home one day after duty, and my marriage was just on the rocks, and communication was very bad. And I just kind of flipped out one day, and I broke a bunch of stuff in my house. Ended up getting charged for domestic violence, and the charges later got, you know, pled down to disorderly conduct. I didn't assault my spouse or anything, but I was just really out of control. I stuck a gun in my mouth, and I was going to blow my head off right there in front of my wife and my 6 week old daughter. And I was just devastated that my life had come to that point. And so I ended up resigning from my job that night and entering a mental hospital for about a week. And, you know, since being out of law enforcement, I've been hospitalized about 7 times for severe PTSD and depression issues from my law enforcement career. But what really changed my life is November 2013, I ended up going to jail again. I was involved in a domestic violence issue in my home. And again, I didn't touch my spouse in this, but I got triggered by a YouTube video of an officer getting killed. And so I ended up kicking a bedroom door in, and I went to jail for it. And, you know, I deserved to go. And that was what changed my life. The court system at that point told me that, you know, because it was domestic violence related, I needed to get an anger assessment to the court. So as I'm going to get this assessment one day, I find out that I'm going to be seeing a female that's doing the assessment. And I was thinking to myself, oh Lord, a female's probably not going to be very lenient on a man. She's probably going to hammer me and not have very much compassion or understand why I've got to where I've got and what got me in this situation. But I was wrong about her. She was an amazing woman. And what was supposed to be a 45-minute assessment turned into 2 hours. And when I walked out of there, she said, Troy, I'm not concerned about you having an anger issue. She said, you have a severe PTSD issue, and I'm really surprised you're not dead. And so she offered her services to me to help me. She said, I would love to walk through this with you and help you get past this. So, you know, I told her I'd think about it. And when I left, I really didn't have any intentions of seeing her, because those issues hurt so bad. I mean, I couldn't even think about talking about it without weeping like a baby. So I just did not want to deal with those and have to work through that, because it was so painful. And I was worried of, you know, those suicide feelings intensing. But God spoke to my heart that night in bed, Randy, and he said, you know, you have two choices. You can let her help you and let her help change your life, or you can continue living this way, and who knows, you may end up dead. So I reached out to her, and we worked for about a year together very intensely. And I ended up getting off all those meds. And I can tell you now, since that time, I've had absolutely no PTSD issues or depression, and I take no medications at this time.
That is absolutely amazing. And, you know, of all the takeaways that I'd like my listening audience to realize, is that it may appear that things are so dark that there will never be light again. And yet you are a perfect example of how you can come back from this. If you are talking to the right person. You know, sometimes, I mean, how many professionals did you talk to before you hooked up with this woman that was able to really reach you and help you?
I bet I talked to 4 or 5 over those years, if not more.
And this is really critical. This is really critical that, just like police officers, psychologists and psychiatrists are all individual people with different skills, different ways that they look at treatment for post-traumatic stress. And you may have to field several before you find somebody that you're going to be compatible with.
Right.
You can't stop looking for that person until you find them. as you did.
That's a great point, Randy. You just can't give up hope. And PTSD and depression, that's what it does to you, is it disables you. And it makes you not want to fight anymore. And you start losing hope that no one can help you. But that is a lie. And life is worth living. I'm a man of faith, and I thank God every morning I wake up for the breath I'm able to take today and help another person.
Do you think that being a man of faith, do you think that's also part of how you were healed?
Absolutely. I sure do. I surrounded myself with some men that just wouldn't give up on me. And times that I was walking through very dark stuff, you know, I was scared to tell them. But what I found that being real is how you heal. You can't heal from hiding shame and guilt and staying in the dark. You have to bring light to whatever's going on in your life. And that's how I healed. I was real with these guys. And again, with my counselor.
Being real is how you heal. That's a very prophetic statement.
It's a basic simple, but that's just how God told me. He said, if you just be real, you're going to heal. And so I believe that God just brought amazing people in my life and saved me from being dead right now.
Well, let's go. I want to go back to a little something that I think might also be significant. So, you know, you were a dedicated police officer for 12 years, a sheriff's deputy. You know, you had a relationship with your sheriff. You had close friendships on the department. What happened when everyone realized that you had post-traumatic stress issues?
Well, I felt very abandoned, to be honest. From the night I resigned and I went into the hospital, I didn't have anybody from my agency reach out to me, and no one called. And then even over the years, it just seemed like they all forgot about me. And I felt very abandoned, and it like, you know, I was no longer a part of the family. And so that piece of it is really kind of stung over the years. But, you know, God has delivered me from that also. And
do you think that
reminded?
Do you think that maybe that also exacerbated the symptom of post-traumatic stress, is feeling like you're completely alone and abandoned by the guys that were basically your family?
Yeah, you're right on the bullseye, Randy. Man, that played a huge part in my PTSD and my suicidal thoughts and my attempts. That right there, if I would have just had the love and support from them guys, knowing, okay, I'm not going to be an officer anymore, but these guys still love me and they support me, that would have been huge for me.
There's, of all the lessons to be learned, you know, I wish that we would heed those words that you just said. You know, the relationships that we develop in our police careers, you know, we're literally willing to put our life on the line for our brothers and sisters. And yet, when illness, either mental or physical, robs us of our careers, very often, those that we feel like were going to be there for us just disappear. And that's really disappointing. Really disappointing emotionally.
Yes, sir. And again, I think a lot of it is they don't know what to say, so they just don't say anything at all. And that can be very dangerous for a guy that was supposed to be a part of their family.
So you have basically remade your life. And how does it feel now? I mean, you were in intensive treatment with someone who was a really good, was she a psychologist or a psychiatrist?
She's a psychiatrist, and she had worked in the prisons before. She had a a law enforcement background, but she had a lot of experience with PTSD, so that helped me open up to her, because she understood where I was at and what I was dealing with versus someone that had never dealt with any type of law enforcement issue.
And she practices where?
She's here in Kansas City.
Okay, so...
I'm not sure she's with the organization that she was with when I was seeing her, but she's still around, and I'm in contact with her now and then, and I reach out to her, and I thank her often for saving my life.
I'll bet. And for my listening audience, that if you are in that area, if you are in law enforcement in the Kansas City area, if you contact me and you want to get the information about this psychiatrist, I'm sure that Troy will share that with us. If that's needed. So what are you doing now, Troy?
I work for a company. It's a analytic risk mitigation company. It's a software that was developed to monitor and prevent suicide. It monitors social media.
That's an appropriate thing to do.
Well, I have a passion just to help others, and you know, I wouldn't care if I made $5 an hour. If I was helping someone and could save a life, that's all that matters to me.
You know, once you have that servant spirit, I don't think that it ever goes away, and you apparently clearly have never lost that servant spirit.
No, I love helping people, and I'm passionate about, you know, sharing my story with others. I don't share it in shame or guilt or fear anymore. I share it. I'm proud of my story and how I got through it. And I know that, you know, mine's just one of many out there. It's no more traumatic than some other people's stories, but I enjoy sharing because people need to know that there's hope and there's ways to get past those pits of hell that PTSD puts you down in.
You know, I want to personally thank you for coming onto the show. I think that and I think it takes courage to talk about, you know, something so deeply personal, but I think that your words that are heard by my listening audience, I think that you may have a serious impact on a number of lives because of your honesty. So I want to thank you again for being on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. Your message is very powerful, and I appreciate you taking the time to come on here.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Randy. I've been a huge fan of yours for years, and I just want to thank you for being the voice that a lot of us don't have. And God bless you. You're an amazing man.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
The Out Loud Perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutLoud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
End of watch.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we honor those who have made the ultimate sacrifice and given their lives in the line of duty. This week, I have two names to read. The first is Sergeant Michael Shannon Robinson of the Christiana Care Health System Department of Public Safety in Delaware. Sergeant Michael Robinson suffered a fatal heart attack while responding to assist nursing staff who were dealing with a disorderly and combative patient at Wilmington Hospital. He collapsed as he responded to the scene at approximately 6 p.m. Sergeant Robinson was a U.S. Navy veteran, had served with the Christiana Care Health System Department of Public Safety for 13 years. He also served as a volunteer firefighter. He's survived by his wife, three children, parents, and two brothers. Constables with the Christiana Care Health System are commissioned Delaware law enforcement officers. Sergeant Michael Shannon Robinson, Christiana Care Health System Department of Public Safety. End of watch, Thursday, October 12th, 2017. The second officer is Police Officer Justin Leo of the Girard Police Department in Ohio. Police Officer Justin Leo was shot and killed while responding to a domestic disturbance call at 408 Indiana Avenue at approximately 10:15 p.m. The subject was intoxicated and was known to have firearms inside the home. Responding officers made contact with the subject, who produced a handgun and shot Officer Leo. Another officer returned fire and killed the suspect. Officer Leo was transported to a local hospital where he succumbed to his wounds. He had served with the Girard Police Department for 5 years. Police Officer Justin Leo, Girard Police Department, Ohio. End of watch, Saturday, October 21st, 2017. These men gave their lives in the line of duty for the community that they served. May they rest in peace. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. Now, I'm your host, Randy Sutton. You can find me at Facebook. If you look under Facebook and you see Randy Sutton Public Figure, just like that or follow it, and you can see everything that I write and post. You can communicate with me there as well. I answer all of my messages personally. You can also find me at Twitter at LT Randy Sutton, LT Randy Sutton at Twitter. And you can find my books at Amazon.com. I have 4 books, and I think you'll like them. A Cop's Life, True Blue, Police Stories by Those Who Have Lived Them, True Blue to Protect and Serve, and The Power of Legacy. Thanks again.